Good evening, everybody. This is James McCanny with my Science Hour, April 13th, 2023. And of course, the official name of this show is the James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. And it seems like we're always at a crossroad of some kind. Tonight, I'll be talking about a really, really interesting thing that came in from a listener. I love when listeners send things in. But this has to do with an archaeological issue regarding the Hopi Indians. So I'm going to jump right into this topic tonight because it may take pretty much the whole show. It's rather complicated because I'm going to go through the physics of how these horned comets work. What's the physics behind them? How do they manifest horns literally coming out the side of the bull's head? And there are many biblical references to the horns of the bull. And if you look in, for example, the Colburn also, any of these ancient texts have references to the horned bull, and that's relative to comets. Okay, so just going back a little bit, in, about 2010, that's just a round number, I was in Universal Studios in Los Angeles filming a series that probably many of you have seen because they replay it many times. It's a six-part series called Apocalypse Now on the History Channel. And so I'm one of the guests, and I think I'm in all six episodes, at least five, if not all six. But I was the local expert on the Hopi Indians, and the idea was that there were legends dealing with Planet X and Hale Bopp. Now, the Hopi back then were talking publicly and apparently went to the United Nations to warn the world, which they were scoffed at, of course, relative to this incoming Planet X object, which, as you will find out if you read my book, the real, this is the book on Planet X, the most recent one, came out a couple of years ago. The Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X, is the title, and that, of course, is available on my webpage. But the idea is that Hale Bopp, literally the comet Hale Bopp, was Planet X. And it had a companion, which was denied by the astronomical community. And what is the big issue about a companion? Well, if you have a companion, in a very simple astronomical equation, you can determine the mass of the central object, and therefore you can determine how big it is, that the nucleus of Hale Bopp was not this 40-mile-across little teeny snowball thing, but it was a raging planet-sized object. And originally it was on a direct collision course with Earth. I explain all of this in the book. But the Hopi Indians, in 1992, went to the United Nations and repeatedly went to the United Nations, according to some sources, some recent sources, and tried to warn the world of this impending disaster. And this is where the blue and the red Kachina dolls come from. Now, if you go through the American Southwest and you drive through the Native American reservation land there, which is immense, you cannot stop at a gas station, you cannot stop at any tourist attraction without seeing Kachina dolls, and there's the red one and the blue one. And so what their belief was that the blue Kachina was a little smaller, and that was Hale Bopp, and it would be followed by a bigger one, the red Kachina, which would be the larger comet, the one that apparently had some damage on Earth in previous times. And just to also to note another book that I recently published, it's called The Real History of Man and Earth, Myth, Magic, and Mayhem. Now, the entire point of that book is that we're in an era now where many people are calling into question the standard dating methodology of the ancient Egyptians, of all of these different civilizations that went under. And by the way, I'm having a little issue with my voice tonight. I have kind of this cough going on, so excuse my voice. So the main point of this book my most recent book, is that we really don't know dating of anything. The Egyptian pyramids, of the Maya, of the Olmecs, of the we have a little bit of information on the Aztecs. The Incas, we know very, very little. Things like the Nazca Lines, we absolutely know nothing. And many of the ancient ruins, we really don't know anything about at all. People are trying to come out and put dates on things, like, oh, this happened at the end of the Younger Dryas period or something, which there's really no, these are people just putting together, you know, tertiary facts that really don't add up to being able to put a definitive date on these cultures, on when the cultures ended, when they had catastrophic demises, etc. So at any rate, back to the Hopi. The Hopi are still living today. They're still active today. Anyway, this book that I'm about to talk about came out in 1899. So that's at the turn of the 19th century. So 1899, it was published in the American Anthropologist, which is an anthropology journal, in the July issue, 1899. And then it was republished as a book in New York by Putnam and Sons, which is a publishing house in New York City. But this is to give you an idea of the quality of anthropology and archaeology in those days. So the story is that a man who was studying the Hopi Indians went out and was gathering information from the elders, from the priests, from the learned people in the Hopi area down in the American Southwest, and someone told him about this cave where there were a couple artifacts. So he went there, and he grabbed them, and one was about 4 feet tall, and one was a little shorter, and these were Kachina dolls, but of what they were called the Alosaka. And now, this was a cult, this was like a priest cult, that continued the ceremonies, etc. And the central deity, the Kachina doll, relative to this cult, and I don't like that word cult because it has, in modern day, it has bad implications. But it was a religious group, let's just call it that instead of cult, because although that's the title of the book, the title of the book is Alosaka Cult of the Hopi Indians. And this is available. You can see it online. You can download it. It's not a book that's for sale. But what he did is he absconded with these statues that were in this cave. And almost immediately, he was besieged by the Hopi elders saying, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I didn't know this. I thought that this was a cave that you people didn't use." They said, "No, we use these regularly in our ceremonies." So the guy returned them, and then there were also some paintings involved, some ancient paintings. And the dolls were made of wood. So these were very ancient, let's say, artifacts. And they were part of the Hopi religion. Okay, so in discovering what these were all about, because one of them was in the form of a bird. Now, I have on my webpage, and I'm not sure where, I think in the Pictures of the Day subpage, there's a picture of the Southwest, the phoenix, which is the bird. Remember, the earth rises up out of the ashes left by the phoenix. And so, in other words, the phoenix was a destroyer of earth. And if you look at phoenix, it's a bird with its wings spread out and curving back in the form of a comet. But the if there were comets in recent history in the last 20 years that took on the form of the phoenix. So that was a very important thing to note here. And the other Kachina doll in this ceremonial group of artifacts had horns, and they looked like the horns on a bull. Now, what we're talking about here is the the physical effects of what a comet does when it's in near an object with a large magnetic field, like Jupiter, like the Sun, or like Earth. Or it could be like another planet, like Saturn has a large magnetic field, and also the outer planets have somewhat strong magnetic fields. But those are the big ones. Those are the big ones that have magnetic fields, are Earth, Jupiter, and the Sun, and Saturn. So what is the cause of this? Now, let me, before I go into the physics of how this works, just remind you that there's a moon of Jupiter called Io. Io is the closest moon to Jupiter of the Galilean four moons. These are the moons that Galileo saw in his little handmade telescope and showed them revolving around Jupiter. And of course, he got in a lot of trouble for that because the world was not ready to understand that the things orbited other things. The belief was that the Earth was the center of the universe and everything revolved around Earth. But of course, Galileo was with science and with investigation was proving otherwise. But we have that same kind of ivory tower mentality today where you say something, and this is what my work has met with for the last 45 to 50 years, is that the scientific community simply will not accept change. But at any rate, what's going on at Io? Well, Io has, or some people call it Io, the issue is that there is an electrical current that attaches between Io and the north pole of Jupiter and the south pole of Jupiter, and that causes there's big auroral spots there where these currents come in. And so what is causing this? Why do they come out of Io in the form of bulls of a horn? Now, if you were looking in the visible spectrum, you would not be able to see these. So these current sheets are not powerful enough to illuminate the material in the coma. And that's what happens in a comet, is you have a comet that's near a body with a magnetic field. And I'll go into the physics of this in a minute, but it's kind of like an end run in football. So in what's an end run in football, American football, is you have this big line up in front of you. You're not opening up the line. All of these big linemen are fighting it out. So the easiest thing to do is run around them. And that's what's going on in a physics sense, because Io, it being the closest moon, has the biggest electrical discharge between Jupiter and its nebular ion cloud, its capacitor. So Io has the largest discharge, but it's the closest moon to Jupiter, and it also lies within Jupiter's very strong magnetic field. Now, there's other things at work. I'm not going to go into all of that. Maybe at the end of this show I'll get into some more of these details of why is Jupiter relatively charged relative to its nebular ion cloud. So it's much like the Sun, where you have a proton wind. You have a proton wind, and the excess current of protons forms a capacitor. Any object within that capacitor, which would be the four Galilean moons, is going to discharge that capacitor. But like I said, Io has some special conditions that the other three moons do not have. And number one is it's closest to Jupiter, so it's receiving the biggest discharge, electrical discharge, of all the moons. So somehow that current has to get to Jupiter, which is left with a net negative charge in this electrical circuit. But there's a little problem. When the electrical current between Io and Jupiter tries to cross that gap, there's a strong magnetic field there. So what happens when current is moving in a magnetic field, it is diverted sideways. The electrons go one way, the protons go the other way, and it just scrambles it. So what happens, this is like the end run in the football game, where the easiest way for that current to get to Jupiter is to follow the field lines. Now, let me give you another example where this kind of phenomena occurs. When you see the northern lights on Earth, what's happening there is you have electrical currents that are part of this overall electrical discharge that the Earth has with the sun in the discharge. And then there's also the solar wind, the proton-rich solar wind coming out from the sun. And so when those try and penetrate Earth's magnetic field, the protons go one way, the electrons go the other way, and there's really no way for those currents to get down to Earth because they're going around it, because they're blocked by the magnetic field. However, the one path of least resistance is following the magnetic field lines in. That's the path on which there is no diversion from the normal path. So a straight line in a magnetic field, when you're talking about potential differences, voltages in outer space, a straight line is really a curved line following the magnetic field lines. And that's what's going on. So with EO, you can determine, using spacecraft sensors, you can determine that there's an electrical current coming off of EO going up to the North Pole, and then a current equally going down to the South Pole. And so what's going on there? Well, you can see the auroral patches, and there's actually a glow all the way around Jupiter's North Pole and South Pole, which are constant auroras. And this is a mixture of different sources of aurora. It's the solar wind. It's the electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. It's the discharge from EO having its two horn-like currents going one to the North Pole of Jupiter, one to the South Pole of Jupiter. And if you could see this, if you could see this in like visibly, if you could change the infrared that's going on, or another way of doing this would be if you could scatter some material in this area. And that's what happens with a comet, is you have a lot of dust and gases in that region around the comet head. So when these electrical currents come out in the form of horns, like horns of a bull, literally, they light up, they illuminate the material in the comet head, in the comet coma, not the comet nucleus, but in the comet coma, and it gives you the form, the sensation of horns of a bull. And that's why in ancient texts and ancient writings in the Bible, every place ancient that you look, you find, especially when they're talking about ancient disasters, ancient comets, etc. And yes, the ancients very well knew, just like they knew that the Earth was not flat, they very much knew that comets were the harbingers of doom. They caused a lot of damage. And of course, they knew that not all comets caused damage, but they understood that the big ones did. There were physical effects from the big comets. And so you will find also the Kachina dolls, then of the Hopi Indian, reflect this. They reflect the visual nature. And of course, the Hopis didn't know what was going on. They didn't know about comets or comet orbits. They did not know about the physics of magnetic fields or the discharge of the solar capacitor or the solar wind or anything else involved in this. They didn't know that Jupiter had a magnetic field or that it had four moons or, you know, there's many things that they had no idea of. But they then reflected in their drawings, in their religions, the whole issue of Kachina dolls representing the discharges. Now, there's another Kachina doll that's very famous. And you will find people in the American Southwest, it's very common if you're on a Native American lands or something like that, or you see any kind of ceremony, there's the Kachina doll known as Cocopelli. Now, who is Cocopelli? Now, Cocopelli is a hunchback flute player that dances and has long hair coming off the back of his head. Well, doggone it, who is that? Now, understand that when the comet discharges, most of the time, very rarely, is the discharge aligned with the tail. The discharge that's visible is off at an angle, and that's why you have the hunched back, and it literally looks that way. If you look at a comet, that's discharging the solar capacitor and has a sunward spike, Very rarely does that sunward spike follow the same path as the tail, etc. It is off sometimes at a very askew angle. So what that does is it makes the comet look like a hunchback. And why is this related to somebody playing the flute? Well, the noise, the electromagnetic noise, vibrates in the atmosphere and causes a flute-like sound. So the comet, the presence of the comet in the sky, is a representative of a flute player, and this is what it looks like, and it's dancing. A comet is moving around. It's not a stationary object, so the tail is moving around. And the ancients saw these because they had very clear skies. Can you imagine the southwestern American skies back in the day when this was, there were no lights of any kind. There were no Las Vegas lights. There were no lights from any place around. It was perfectly dark. So they had a very good view of sometimes very subtle effects like infrared or ultraviolet, things that are just at the far edges of the optical nerve system of the human eye. And of course, these people were very tuned to infrared too. They could see auras. Their eyes were very trained. So a lot of these effects, like the moving comet tail, let me give you an example. This was back in the Hale-Bopp days in the 1990s. And there was an astronomer, a professional astronomer, had his own amateur equipment, but good amateur equipment, and he lived in Florida. And he was taking pictures of Hale-Bopp time-lapse photography with what was known as a Swan filter. Now, a Swan filter in astronomy measures the ionized oxygen and hydrogen. And so what happens is you're seeing the water tails of the comet, and they're flailing around. There were like 14 tails. And that's what the ancients talked about when they talked about the comet Venus, is it had, you know, a dozen tails all flailing around at the same time. And you could see in this time-lapse photography that this astronomer made, you know, and this would be on the order of hours, not days or months, but on the order of hours. So these streamers are flailing around as the hydrogen and water come in, are joined together to create water, and then giving off this tremendous amount of heat or light. And it's just like, it'd be just like the space shuttle going up, which uses the hydrogen and oxygen in its first stage. You know, a tremendous fire coming out because they're combining hydrogen and oxygen, but this comet is going on in outer space. So at any rate, all of these things add up to be the makings of comets, of ancient comets. And so what does it tell us when they're talking about the phoenix shape, the bird shape? It's kind of a fan shape that when these comets get closer to the sun, they will take on that shape. They become very energetic. Then the two horns, the horns of the bull, which, like I say, are referenced in the apocalypse and other biblical references, the horns of the bull, refer to comets that are very energetic. These are not little teeny Halley's comets, you know, and this is the problem with modern astronomy. These people are locked into this fable that comets are little. They lied about Hale-Bopp. They said it was 40 miles across. Absolutely ludicrous. And, you know, they're literally professional liars. So you can never get a straight answer out of any of these people. But the ancients really had no bone to pick. If you look at the cover of my book, Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, you will see on the cover petroglyphs, drawings on rock walls. These came from Green River, Utah. And I think the photographer, I'm not sure if he's still with us, because this was like 20 years ago. He sent me this photo, and this is back in the before the digital photo. He sent me the real photo that he took. And that is on the cover of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. It shows two comets, one with a very large nucleus. Now, if you understand how large comets are, this would make this nucleus probably about the size of Jupiter. And they both have squiggly sunward spikes coming out the nose. Now, these were drawn on rocks by, these were petroglyphs drawn by Native American indigenous people. Who knows, hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, we don't know. So anyway, all of these different characteristics of high-energy comets are seen in ancient drawings. In the astronomical community, does not investigate these when NASA sends a probe up to visit, say, Jupiter or something like that, or a comet. It does not investigate these things. It's assuming that comets are dirty snowballs and that there is no electrical discharge in outer space. And as far as EO is concerned around Jupiter, they just sweep it under the rug. They pretend that they have some stupid explanation that there's a dynamo going on. And it's really, it's the exact opposite, as with most of NASA's explanations. It's the exact opposite of what is actually going on, that the discharge, or let's take another example. When we talk about lightning in Earth's atmosphere, now they have discovered finally that the electrical discharge related to lightning, so lightning bolts coming down and hitting Earth, they used to say, or still do, that the lightning is caused by these tumultuous winds, updrafts, etc., in a cloud, and that forms electricity, and then that comes shooting down to ground. The only problem is now that if you look above the cloud, you have electrical elves and sprites and all of these other electrical phenomena above the cloud. So what the cloud is doing is it's really just a small portion of the electrical current in the vertical electric field of Earth. Now, the reality is, if you look at the standard explanation for how lightning forms, is that the cloud is a conductor. Whenever a conductor is placed in an electric field, whether it's uniform, non-uniform, whatever, the conductor has free electrons, free charge that can move. And so what happens is around the edge of the conductor, it forms a distribution of charge that effectively causes the field inside the conductor to be zero at all points. Now, this is basic electromagnetic theory 101. And, of course, most people, meteorologists included, geologists, atmospheric scientists, whatever, really don't know these simple facts because they never took advanced physics. They dropped out maybe after physics 101. And so they never learned some of these basic physical principles, so that when they talk about clouds producing electricity and electricity shooting out the top and the bottom of the cloud, with the electricity being generated in the cloud, it simply cannot be true. It's just absolute absurdity. In other words, if you had a battery source of voltage, it would discharge internally before it would ever discharge externally, because the shortest path of least resistance is within the battery itself. And so the discharge is not going to occur outside. It's the same with a volcanic plume. If you have a volcanic plume reaching up to the sky, all of a sudden it starts discharging electricity. They make the same statement, that it's the tumultuous activity in the plume that causes the electrical discharges around the volcanic plume. Absolutely could not possibly be true because of basic laws of physics. You cannot have the source of battery energy, voltage, you cannot have that discharging outside of the battery. Simply not going to happen. That would be like expecting that if you had a D or a C cell battery, or a D or a AA or a AAA battery on a table, that it would discharge outside. Of course, if you put a wire to it, that's one thing. But in the natural setting, a volcano cloud or a atmospheric cloud for water, rain, does not have that property. You don't have a wire going from the top to the bottom. And even if you did, there's still an issue that the dielectric in the atmosphere is going to prevent electrical buildup. These are all examples of standard science having no clue what they're doing. Just a quick review then. The Alosaka cult of the Hopi Indians demonstrated in their kachina dolls, these kachina dolls with the horns. I've explained why those kachina doll horns are significant and why they represent electrical discharges. I'd also talked about the Kokopelli kachina doll, the dancing flute player, and why that is also relevant. Why would a comet with an electrical discharge create a sound like a flute? And that's because of the electrical nature of the discharge, and it's going to reverberate electrically with the atmosphere of Earth, which is going to cause a whistling or flute-like noise. That's another issue. And then also I talked about the phoenix, which is a shape of a comet, which, which comet I'm trying to think offhand. I have it on my webpage where I have a picture of the phoenix doll with the wings outspread and the comet, which took on the exact shape of a phoenix. And I was very surprised when I saw that, but it was very clear as day that that comet had the perfect shape of a phoenix. And it may be that big comets far away from the sun can take on the shape of a phoenix bird, but I don't know. That still has to be studied as far as looking at real comets. But for sure, the comet that I saw that was in the shape of a phoenix, the bird was relatively close to the sun. Okay, well, I hope that was informative. And once again, the name of this book that I'm referring to, which, by the way, was sent in by a listener. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this because I don't have time to be all over the internet scouring. I'd love to be, scouring the internet. But when you see something interesting, go to the webpage. There's a contact email address there and send it in. So the name of this book was The Alosaki Cult of the Hopi Indians. Author is J. Walter Fewkes, is Fewkes. Once again, published in the American Anthropologist, July of 1899, and republished by Putnam and Sons, New York Publishing House, and the book has the exact same title. And I really did not have time to go into about 99% of this book. A lot of it has to do with the Hopi Indians interacting with the rain gods and the snow gods and the fertilization gods and all the different deities that were in their pantheon of gods that they asked for support to support them in their lives, because you can only imagine life was pretty thin, and if you didn't have a good corn crop back in the day, somebody was probably going to die. Some people were going to starve to death, and only the very hardiest of those people made it through. So it was eminently important every year to have a good harvest. Everybody work hard, and the leaders would have control of this. And part of their ongoing profession of faith was that these deities would take care of them. So they would pray to them and have offerings, etc. And very important for them to survive in this hostile, very hostile environment. And if you've ever been in the American Southwest, it's dry. It's very difficult to grow things. If you had water, you could easily grow things. So they have a very limited growing season. They have very limited access to other resources. And just an amazing, difficult place to live, but they did it. They were able to carry on and still remain today, in spite of modern stresses on their culture. Remind you that if you watch the History Channel, which has a lot of really bogus information on it, unfortunately, but I was part of a History Channel special called Apocalypse Now, and I was the representative of the Hopi during that six-part series, which, as I said, it was probably about 2011, somewhere in that time frame. That was in Los Angeles. That was filmed at Universal Studios in Hollywood. And so it was at about the same time also that I was a guest with George Norrie in the studio in Los Angeles, Coast to Coast AM. And they invited me over there. So I went up that evening, Tom, the producer there, and George. And that night, George was releasing his new book at that time, called Talking to the Dead. So there's a picture of me and George holding up the book and promotion. But they wanted world-class guests to sit in the studio with George and be a guest. So I was, I think, one of the first guests to actually do that. And I think there were some pictures that resulted. Some of them, I believe, were in newspapers and other venues. But anyway, interesting time. So that was at the same trip that I was in Los Angeles filming the History Channel special. Okay, on to a new topic here. Central bank digital currency. Oh my goodness. This is in the news. The failing banks worldwide. Do you think these failures are on purpose? Are they created to cause fear in the banking system? And oh, doggone it, we got to move to this digital currency, which is safer, better. It's all hocus pocus. And of course, this is the new world government, the one world, new world order government, making its play, because if they can get a banking system in that is universal, then they can basically slide in their government, which goes along with it. But there's some problems here. China, Russia, Brazil, other major countries, the BRICS nations, are building up their own SWIFT system. They're building up their own banking system for money transfers, and they're leaving the United States out. The United States, basically through Biden incompetence, but as remember, it's not Biden. Biden is an old guy that has a drool cup that's in a corner. The only time you see somebody that looks like Biden is a body double. And you can tell all kinds of features of this body double that it's not Joe Biden. So whoever's running the show, it's certainly not Joe Biden. So I don't know why people continue to even talk about it. But the whole idea is that this is moving to a central banking system of paperless money, or just, let's say, money without the dollar. And so the idea is to bring all the countries into this system. But like I say, they have a little bit of an issue here with China, Russia, etc., backing their money with gold. China has vast gold reserves. Russia has immense gold reserves, and they're backing their money with gold. So now the United States, with its fiat money, is not worth anything. The whole idea of the American dollar, the petrodollar, all of that is going away. And this is somewhat standard for any republic or empire, you might say, that has existed throughout history. After a couple hundred years, it starts breaking down. The people, the leaders get soft, they get greedy, they start doing things that are for their best interest and not for the interest of the people. They start everything you see today. And then the communism, that's the way they do it, of course. If you look at the Communist Manifesto, everything that's happening today is an absolute result of communism coming in, dividing the country in a million different pieces. You know, all of the identity politics where one person has an identity and he needs to have his voice heard above all others. And then, you know, everything that's going on in the United States, this is nothing new. This has all been done before. But the whole issue of central bank digital currency is related to bank failures. And if they can convince people, which is, if you look at the evening news, which I really don't, I catch a glimpse of it every now and then, because I do radio shows, I'm on interviews, etc., and I have to be up with what's going on in the world, but I don't pay really much attention to it. The bank failures are, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago on my show about the venture capitalists and the failure of the venture capitalist system and the banks failing that were associated with that. There's no way venture capitalism could work based on real economics. There's simply a model that simply never was viable. And I made the point that venture capital, the only reason it worked for a while was because of massive government input into the small startup companies that they were funding. So they would put $2-5 million into a small startup company. It would go off into Never Never Land. They would staff it to the gills with CEOs and vice presidents and all of these people who really didn't do anything. And then they maybe had five engineers building a product that had no future at all, and then these things would collapse. And so the whole model didn't work. But the only reason it worked is because then the government would come in and buy these products, many of which had no future at all, no ability to do anything, but the government threw money at it. And that's the only reason why venture capital worked. And it really didn't work. It was just getting this artificial money pumped in from the government. And so once that whole system started breaking down, where real companies had to produce real products to make real profits to support the company, there was no way these venture capital run companies could support themselves. So they all just collapsed under their own weight. But this is being used in the collapse of the SVB and the other banking entities out in Silicon Valley is being used as a fear-mongering that the banking system is about ready to collapse. Well, it's been collapsing for a very long time because of fractional reserve banking, where they lend thousands of times more money than they have to cover the loans. And then when the loans fail, they're left there with nothing. They're holding air. Big balloon full of air that's ready to pop at any moment. So anyway, just be on the lookout. I'm not going to talk a lot about digital bank currency or central bank digital currency. I'm not going to talk a lot about that other than just become aware of it and look for real sources of information, because the evening news is really filled with, let's just put it this way, a lot of garbage, a lot of misinformation, a lot of fear porn relative to what's going to happen or what might happen. Okay, on to another topic. The MR5 whole house water filter is on sale. That sale is going to end Sunday. We met our goal, and so we thought, okay, we'll just let people know if you're interested in the MR5, there's a big discount now. And my recommendation is you look at the best deal package. It's the MR5, which comes with the original set of filter elements, stainless steel casing, highest quality water filter in the world. Then the UV sterilizer, which is a follow-on. We call it a filter. It's not really a filter. It's an ultraviolet sterilizer. That's included in the best deal. And then also an extra set of filter elements for the MR5, and the UV sterilizer comes with two bulbs so that they are changed out once a year, so you have basically 2 years worth of bulbs for the ultraviolet sterilizer and about 2 years worth of filtration with the extra set of filter elements that come with the MR5 for an average household of four people. That would get you out a couple of years without having to purchase any extra water filters, and it's on sale literally. It was the regular price is like $26.10, and actually the regular price is $28.10, and then of course we have $200 deduction. But right now, the best deal until Sunday is $19.80. So that's like literally $600 off that package. So anyway, I encourage you to go there, and we will send you the instructions, etc., how to install it. Typically, you get a plumber, a local plumber, to install it, and we'll work with them on the phone or sending them information, whatever it takes, so that they install it, carefree operation, etc. But it's really an amazing deal, and it's going away. The pricing is going to go back up to $2,600 on Monday morning. Let's put it that way. So get your order in now. Also, remember, we sell the water filter elements to replace the gravity water filters that you have, the stainless steel, or they might be plastic, or they might even be ceramic containers for gravity water filtration. We sell the best all-in-one filter on the market, bar none, and at the very best price, too. I can't believe how much some of these companies are charging for their replacement filter elements. It's just unreal. Sometimes 2 to 3 times what I'm charging. And so mine are the best. They're the best price. And of course, on all of this, free shipping to the USA. If it goes to Canada, we're now shipping to Canada. We'll get some orders from Canada. We just charge you a little bit extra to ship it to Canada. All of it goes out UPS. But we ship it to Canada now also. And if you're ordering from Canada, what we do is you put in your order, and then we calculate some shipping. We send you a PayPal invoice for the extra shipping. And by the way, we take part of that shipping price off, because the equivalent of what you would it would cost to ship it in the U.S. of A., because we have free shipping in the U.S. of A. So anyway, Canadians are also included. We're not shipping to foreign countries at this point. It just got too complicated. But remember that. And then also we have this product, Make Your Own, where you buy your own physical containers. We show you how to do that, where to get them. Food-grade quality containers. You drill a couple holes, which is really not rocket science. Anybody can do it. And then we sell you a world-class stainless steel spigot with our HI gravity filter elements, and you make your own filter. So anyway, all of that on the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. That's jmccwaterfilters.com. Go there. And then also just remember, my new book is for sale on my main webpage, which is jmccsci.com, short for J. McCanny Science. So jmccsci.com. Go there. And also that book is available in hardcover on Amazon. It's the name of the book, The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. So anyway, a little bit of telling you about the products. And that's, by the way, I don't have sponsors. I don't have government contracts. I don't have all of this support that other places have. I just do this based on what you purchase. And people are very happy because I have the best products on the planet. Okay, next topic, the solar maximum, for those of you interested in this, will be coming later in 2023 or early 2024, according to predictions from solar physicists. And this solar cycle has been going on for forever, since they discovered it, where the magnetic field of the sun switches every 11 years. So the magnetic field switches from north to south. And no, that does not cause Earth to go into convulsions. It's just the normal situation with the sun. And the 2009 solar maximum was historically very low because Hale-Bopp had been discharging the solar capacitor for a period of about 10 years, really, when it first showed up and started. It was like 1995. But in the solar maximum, it was still affecting because the solar capacitor had been severely drained. So the solar maximum in 2009 was historically low. But now we're back to the point where it appears that this solar maximum number 25 will get back up to normal heights, or at least close to it. So we're looking for that. But that just shows you, when a planet is formed, like Hale-Bopp, the amount of energy it takes to make that planet. So the birthing process for planets is a lot of energy. It takes a lot of energy. The other thing with Hale-Bopp was in 2002 solar maximum, there was a double peak, which is the first time that ever happened, and that happened at the end where Hale-Bopp was basically pumping up the energy in the solar system, in the sun, and caused a double peak, which you never have seen before or since. But that's a direct result also of Hale-Bopp, the large comet, discharging the solar capacitor. And of course, standard science, standard astrophysics, space science doesn't know anything about this. They have no clue why all of a sudden, when a big comet is in the solar system, you would have a double peak solar maximum, or why the following solar maximum would be very low. And of course, they don't relate any of these. Okay, so anyway, for those of you interested, the solar maximum coming later this year. This is an interesting story. Minnesota has two nuclear power plants. One is in Monticello, Minnesota, on the Mississippi River. Maybe it's the Minnesota River, I'm not sure, northwest of Minneapolis. And then there's the Prairie Island nuclear facility that's down in the Mississippi River. But the Monticello plant shut down this past week, and a lot of fish died. Now, one would surmise, when I first heard this story, that there was a leak. This is literally what it said. There was a leak from the Monticello nuclear power plant, and fish died. And so my first reaction was, holy cow, they had a nuclear release of toxic nuclear waste into the river that killed fish. When you actually read the story, what they're claiming is that it was due to the temperature change, which is understandable, because what happens is the warm water comes out of the reactor. It creates a warm region there where the fish can hang out literally all year long with warm temperatures. And if that shuts down, then all of a sudden you have this very rapid change to cold temperatures. And this is what the article was saying, but I didn't hear anybody else talking about the possibility that it was a nuclear release, literally a pipe breaking, where a nuclear reactive material went into the river. And that's the impression I got when I first saw the title. And apparently that's not the case. They're saying it was only due to the change in temperature. So I don't know. I'm going to try and research this a bit more, but I haven't been able to find any real reliable information. And it could be that somebody's just trying to cover, because these plants in Minnesota are trying to get, they are run by Xcel Energy, they're trying to get billions of dollars in funding to keep them open. And nobody wants to foot up the bill. So who knows, maybe this is just a ploy to say, look, we got to have funding to keep these nuclear facilities running. So I don't know. It kind of smells of rotten fish, if you know what I mean. And literally, it did smell like rotten fish because it killed, now they said 250 fish. So in an ecosystem like the river there, 250 fish would not be a big number. But if they were killed by radiation, then that would be a different story, because now you have radioactive fish, you have the water, you have the downstream, you have all these issues related with toxic water from a nuclear waste facility, from a nuclear facility. Anyway, I don't know. I'm going to have to research this a bit more to see if I can find out some more detailed information. And I don't see any independent agencies or government agencies stepping up to the plate here and putting out information either. So, like I say, I'll have to research this more, but they're talking about a pipe that broke and released the heating. And they're taking this pipe, they cut it out, they said in the article, to send it away for laboratory testing to see why it failed. Well, if you have piping failed in a nuclear power plant, whether it's just cold, hot water, or whether it's another, you know, related to the nuclear reactive material, it's not a good issue because it's just indicative. It's like if you have an old car and the left rear shock goes out, is that probably indicator that a lot of other things are just about to go wrong with that car. The same thing with a nuclear power plant. There's a lot of other things lurking in there that are about to go wrong. And these facilities are very old, they're very aging. And my opinion is they should be shut down. But the problem is, then they're going to be left with a vacuum. They say that they have enough power to power the region, in spite of the fact that that facility went offline, which may be true, which begs the question, well, why do you need it then? If you have enough capacity in your production of electricity where you don't need the Monticello plant, why are you keeping it open? Why don't you shut it down? And the answer is they don't have the money to decommission that plant. In the beginning of the nuclear industry of producing electricity from nuclear power, there was a regulation and that all of these power plants should be setting aside money every month, every year, into a slush fund. And that slush fund was to pay for the decommissioning of these plants. Nobody ever did it. The money went someplace else, who knows where. It would be something to investigate, but now as any of these things where public trust is just obliterated, you have a catastrophic situation where we have 104 active nuclear power plants. I think that was the last number I was familiar with. Might be less than 100 right now. But that many power plants that have to be decommissioned, and the cost of this, especially since they're way over their lifetime, what does decommissioning mean? You have to get rid of all of the waste. Now, in the modern world of nuclear power, they're using fuel rods that have to be cooled. That was never the intention. So now you have to continually generate power to cool the fuel cells after they're used, the nuclear fuel rods. Okay, so anyway, I'm just about out of time here. A lot of major topics covered tonight. I've been doing this radio show now for 23 years, commercial-free and without sponsors, etc., because it's the only way to have a truthful discussion on these many varying topics. So anyway, just remember my webpage, jmccsci.com, for the webpage, for the books, the education package, etc., and then also the water filter page, jmccwaterfilters.com, where you get the best water filters on the planet for the lowest cost. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.